Hello, everyone. You are listening to a free version of this podcast. To support the show, click the link in the description to go to my Patreon page, patreon.com/psychowarfare, to support the show, where you can access premium content such as exclusive videos and ways to interact with the channel. Thanks for your support, guys, and enjoy the show.
That the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
I have a dream today.
Your body went to sleep, but your mind is still caught up in a warfare. Your mind is the battleground.
It's psychological warfare.
With AJ Norton.
Hello, everyone. Boy, do I have a podcast for you. I've got some good guests coming up, and this is one of my favorite guests and also one of my recent heroes. His name is Derek Jensen. He's the founder of Deep Green Resistance and is a, I guess I would call him a hardcore environmentalist, or he actually advocates for environmentalism, environmental policies that would actually fix the earth and not within the capitalistic culture we find ourselves in today. He has written The Myth of Human Supremacy, A Language Older Than Words, Endgame, Volume 1, Walking on Water, and many other books that I've read. If you want to check him out, you can also find him on YouTube. There are some videos of the Earth at Risk conference in 2014. His opening speech is very good. He covers many things in his books, mostly environmental and how we have many problems to fix if we are going to be cohesive with the Earth and save the Earth. And to save the Earth, remember, everybody, is to save ourselves. That's it, guys. If you enjoy this podcast, I would love it if you became my first Patreon contributor. And you can check that out on psychowarfare.com/Patreon. And also check out some of the blog posts I do. Other than the podcast, I also write down some podcasts, some blogs. I'm doing one on George Orwell right now. I just finished 1984. Okay, guys, enjoy the podcast and love you. You say that environmentalists start off wanting to protect a forest and end up questioning Western civilization. And I think that's such a good point, but I want to ask, how did that happen for you? What was your start in environmental activism?
Well, mine I'll back up a second. How that works for most people, or for most environmentalists, or a lot of environmentalists, is they might begin by trying to stop a particular clear cut because the clear cut's being put in behind their home and it's going to destroy their water supply. And so they will try to stop that, you know, the classic NIMBY, not in my backyard, and then they start to ask, so why is this place being destroyed? And it's to make money. And then they start asking, why is any place being destroyed? And usually it's to make money. And then they start asking, what does it mean to have an economic system based on destroying the land base? And then from there, they can start asking, have there been other economic systems? Have there been other ways to be in which people didn't destroy their land base? And so the questions will just sort of spiral out. And where did this destruction start? So that's how it is for a lot of people. How it was for me is a little bit different in that, my questioning really started when I was a child. My father was very violent. He broke my sister's arm. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And even as a kid, I was asking the question, if his behavior isn't making him happy, why is he doing it? I was wondering, why is he doing this stuff? And of course, I wasn't, you know, so articulate as to be able to say those words when I was five, but that was the question that was hanging in the air. So that was step one. And step two was that when I was in second grade, so that makes me seven or something, they put in a subdivision right next to where I lived. And I remember thinking, and again, I didn't have the language around all this, but I remember thinking, so where are the meadowlarks going to go? And where are the cottonwood trees going to go? And I recognized that you can't keep building forever. And so what the language, I guess I did have that language. The language I didn't have is you can't have an economic system based on infinite growth on a finite planet. And I got that when I was in second grade. Excuse me. So now let's fast forward to, and so then I went to college, and in college, I had this sort of hobby of asking people if they liked their jobs. So I might be riding on a bus. I might be, you know, getting a pizza. I might be just, I got a degree in science. So I might be working with the scientists where I worked who actually did like their jobs. And about 90% of the people I asked, I would ask them, do you like your job? About 90% would say no. And I started wondering, what does it mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? So that sort of led to the question of who's in charge. And, you know, there's a great line by Frederick Winslow Taylor, in the past, the man was first, in the future, the system shall be first. And I just started asking questions about that. And I went to the Colorado School of Mines, which is a very difficult school. And a lot of my fellow students, I didn't like it, and a lot of my fellow students didn't like it either, but they said, you know, this is basically a 4-year boot camp, and when we get out of here, we are going to have so much money working for a petroleum company. And a lot of them were already looking forward to when they were going to retire. And it's like, man, you're 20 years old, and you're thinking about what you're going to do when you're 60. And that just seemed crazy to me. So I started questioning the system in that way then. And then,
So sorry, at that point, at that school, where were you at that point? As in, like, were you at a mindset where all of capitalism, all of civilization needed to go, or were you still not at that point yet? When did you reach kind of the whole system is completely?
Well, that's a great question. And nobody has asked that question before. The question that's been asked is the one about how did I get into environmentalism, which is the story I've just told you. But nobody's asked that one. And that one comes, so then, I get in my mid-20s, I'm just depressed, and I'm thinking, man, the problems are so big, I don't know how we can solve any of these. It's just crazy, blah, blah, blah. And then I got started in activism. We can talk about that if you want or not. But the point is that I was working with these activists. We were protecting, filing timber sale appeals to try to stop the Forest Service from putting out timber sales that would harm the land. And It's sometimes there would be compromises, and it seemed really clear to me that if you give up 50% and then you give up 50% of the 50% you saved, and then you give up 50% of that and 50% of that, it's all going to go. I mean, it's all going to go eventually. And so many of the environmentalists I was working with, we all just recognized that if this continues the way things are going, it's like a friend of mine says, if we continue on the path where, how does he say it? I don't know how he says it, but basically if we continue on this path, we're going to get where we're going. And where we're going is I'm going to put it a different way. That in one of my essays, I talked about how I want to bring down civilization, not because I hate hot showers or because I hate Beethoven's Ninth. I like both of those very much. I want to bring it down because I can do simple math. And I recognize if you have 6 billion passenger pigeons and then 5 billion, 4 billion, then 2 billion, then 1 billion, then a half a billion, that's trending downward. And if you have uncountable salmon, and then you can count them, and then you've got a million, and then you've got a half a million, and now you've got 5,000 coho salmon in California when there used to be a million, that's a pattern that is – this is what we see everywhere we look around, is every major biological indicator is going the wrong direction. So I saw that. So it was a combination of seeing that plus seeing that all the activists that I knew were basically just holding on by our fingernails, trying to protect this or that piece of ground until civilization crashed, that made it all very clear that the problem is civilization that's killing the planet. And one of the ways that I say this oftentimes is, you know, they say one sign of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. I'm going to lay out a pattern. Let's see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years, which is when you think of Iraq as the first thing you think of, cedar forests so thick that sunlight never touches the ground. That's what Iraq was like prior to the beginnings of this culture. And one of the first written myths of this culture is Gilgamesh deforesting the hills and valleys of Iraq and to make a big city. And the Arabian Peninsula was forested and was oak savanna. And the Near East was heavily forested. Greece was heavily forested. A couple thousand years ago, one of those dead Greek philosophers was complaining that deforestation was harming water quality. So it's a pattern that's really old and is also really obvious. I mean, if your way of life is based on extracting from others, then obviously on a finite planet, you're going to run out of places to extract from. So that's where it all came together, is in my early 30s, is where all these disparate pieces coalesced.
No, I think it's really hard to do what you just talked about, because in a way you're fighting the hand that feeds you. If you're fighting civilization, civilization gives you your life, your water, your food. It can be very hard to denounce that.
Well, that's very true, and that's also intentional. And by intentional, I don't mean a conspiracy of a secret cabal of six judges or something. It's like a friend of mine says, you don't have to have a conspiracy when everybody thinks the same. But it has okay, in the 1830s, there was a pro-slavery philosopher wrote to his northern abolitionist buddy saying that there are conditions under which they would give up their slaves right away, because there are conditions in which it's in the capitalist's best interest to own slaves and not own slaves. This is going to come back to your point in a second. And the conditions are, if you have a lot of land and not many people, then that means that people have access to land, which means they have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means that they will never come to work for you except at the point of a gun. Because most people would not go to work for IBM or Walmart or whatever it is they work for if they didn't have to pay rent. But if they could be outside the system, and the system on one level does not actually provide the food. The system is actually provided by the land itself, but it's mediated by the system. The system has inserted itself between you and the land. And that's, I didn't finish the story about the slave owning philosopher. He said, but if you have a lot of people and not much land, that means people don't have access to land, which means they don't have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they don't have access to self-sufficiency, which means they have to go to work for you. And this has been very intentional and conscious, and sort of that cabal of judges a few times. Like in South Africa, the laws of apartheid were set up specifically because they had mines and they didn't have workers. So how are they going to get people to come work in the mines? You know, all the local people were living in subsistence villages, just doing subsistence farming, hunting, gathering, all sustainable, all self-sufficient. Self-sufficient is the key here. And so what they did is they passed poll taxes, hut taxes, dog taxes, all sorts of laws to make it so the people had to get cash, because they were outside of a cash economy. Once they had to get cash, how are they going to get cash? Well, gosh, there's a job there at the mine. And so the laws of apartheid were there specifically because they recognized, it's the same with the American Indians on the plains, that the Europeans recognized that they couldn't bring the Indians to terms as long as the buffalo existed. Because as long as the buffalo existed, that was their grocery store. That was their quartermaster. That was their supply. And if you just, that's like rule one of military strategy, is you destroy the enemy's ability to fight. And as Napoleon, I believe, said, the enemy fights on its stomach. And so if you can destroy their capacity to support themselves, they will have to come to whatever terms you want. So my point in all this is that on a physical level, the system has systematically, sorry to be redundant, but the system has over time insinuated its way and pushed its way in between us and the real world. So until now, you're exactly right that if someone's experience is that their food comes from the grocery store and their water comes from the tap, they will defend to the death that system because their life depends on it. But if their food comes from a land base and their water comes from a river, they'll defend to the death those. This is why the Indian John Mohawk said very famously, there is no sovereignty without food sovereignty. And Kropotkin put this a different way, that he said that so many revolutions have foundered because of bread, because in 60 days you die of starvation. And so you have to, I mean, you make a really, really important point there, that the system has insinuated itself between us and the real world. And so it can be very hard to break that identification, because something else has happened too, which is not only on a physical level this is happening, but this is happening on an emotional level too, where we're identifying with the system. And just a really simple way, and this is a joke I've told for years, but it really works, is that a friend of mine called me up and said, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq? And I looked around and I said, we're in Iraq? I thought we're in Northern California. My friend said, no, how much longer do you think we're going to have troops in Iraq? And I said, I got troops? Holy crap, will they do what I tell them? And then she said, yeah, this is why I only call you once every 6 weeks, and hung up. And the point is that, well, I'll do this one more time, which is I was watching TV with my mom a couple years ago, and they were talking about the United States torturing. My mom said, you know, this is just so terrible that we torture. And I looked at her and I said, Mom, you torture? That's terrible. And she said, I'm 83 years old. I'm your mother. Don't do this to me. And the point of all this is that our identification with the system, I mean, if you look at a lot of bright green technology, you look at all these things where people will say, oh, like there's a news article that said destroying the desert to save the earth. And it was about putting in a big solar power generation facility in the desert. And it's like, actually, no, you're not saving the earth. What you're saving is you're providing additional industrial electricity. This is not saving the planet. And so a lot of times we get all confused. And for one thing, we say we when we mean the United States government. It's not my government. We all know that it's a government by, of, and for the corporations. And so there's that level. And then there's also the level of – so identify with the government. I learned that from Chomsky, by the way, that Chomsky's always very careful. He never says – we invaded Vietnam. He always says the United States government. And that's really important to separate yourself in that way. And I'm not saying that, you know, don't get a driver's license. I mean, of course I've got a driver. If you don't want to get a driver's license, I don't care. But that's not the point. The point is that to not believe that – it's like I've said, to recognize that the government is a government of occupation and – you know, all my American Indian friends say, what took you so long to figure that out? But recognizing it's a government of occupation does not mean any less that it is a government. And, you know, we are, you know, for all my talk here, it's also true that we live in a capitalist system and you got to pay rent and you got to figure out a way to survive in the system as you work to bring it down.
Yes, that's so good. And I think that goes well into my next question. And you've talked about this a lot, so thanks for explaining this. But you've talked about the difference from PTSD and complex PTSD. Can you explain both and why we're kind of born into a complex PTSD?
Oh, sure. So PTSD is where someone is traumatized once. Like someone could be in... Oh, like a great example of this is that, my mom and I were in a terrible car wreck in 1984, 1985. It was in a dark canyon in a rainy night and there was a semi load of plywood. The guy overturned coming the opposite direction right in front of us. I didn't even see it with the dark tarp on the dark night and slammed into the top of it going 55. And, my mom was injured very badly, broke her neck, became functionally blind. And the point is that ever since then, if I were to drive, and especially if she's in the car and it's a canyon on a dark night, she makes me drive really slow. And if I drive by myself through a canyon on a dark night, she wants me to call her when I get out of the canyon because canyons make her really nervous. Are you with me so far? And the same thing can happen like if I've heard this happen with the big earthquake in Oakland in 1989, where now because of what happened, there can be just a small tremor and it can bring up much stronger feelings. Or say someone say a woman is sexually assaulted in a certain type of car, that car may bring up bad feelings for her. Okay, that's PTSD and that's very commonly accepted. And then Judith Herman talked about, okay, what happens if you're not traumatized once or twice, but instead you're actually held in captivity for years? And so, for example, let's say you're a prisoner, or let's say you are raised, like you're the the father is a perpetrator of domestic violence and you're raised in that family, you're in a sense raised in captivity. So instead of the trauma happening once, it's repeated over a long time. And she wrote this, Judith Herman wrote this great book called Trauma and Recovery, in which she lays out some of the ways that complex PTSD might be different than regular PTSD. The regular PTSD, you might have those individual specific triggers. You know, my mom can get very nervous about a dark canyon, but that doesn't affect other parts of her life so much. And if you are having, if you're raised in captivity, if you're held in captivity for a long time, you can come to believe, for example, that all relationships are hierarchical. Though, you know, in a prison, you've got the guards are above the prisoners, and that's very, go ahead, please.
Sorry, it's the same in capitalism. Capitalism is by definition hierarchical, or hierarchy, or I can't say it, hierarchical.
Yeah. Yeah, I hate that word too. I always slur it. Hierarchical.
And, no, you bring up prisons, monarchy, almost, even school has a hierarchy. I don't know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, and one of the things that's also very important to recognize is that, and we can talk more about the hierarchies, and like, the selfish gene is based on ruthless competition. And so one of the things that can happen is you can come to believe that all relationships are based on exploitation. And this is really crucial because we have an entire culture. So many indigenous people have said to me that the most fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into a relationship with. And there is not this – one of the central ideas of Western culture is the great chain of being, where before you had God at the top and then angels and then the king. And then, you know, I don't know whether the lords are above the queen or the queen's above the lords. But anyway, you've got the king, then the queen, then the royalty, and then the commoners, and then the common women. And then you've got the animals and then the plants all the way down. And nowadays, it's the same hierarchy is still in place. It's just that we've taken out God and replaced that with pure reason, with science, essentially, with machines, frankly. And it's still a hierarchy. But one of my recent books, Myth of Human Supremacy, was about how that hierarchy is completely nonsense. And there are – oh, it's so funny. I got to tell you this. Just yesterday, I was at the dentist. And my dentist is generally a pretty conservative guy. I mean, I was just getting regular teeth cleaning. And then he came in for the checkup afterwards. And he was just making conversation. He said, so got any books out lately? And this always makes me nervous when this happens locally. You know, people will say, gosh, Derek, you're so brave to write what you write. And this is not really true because most of the people who read my books are never going to meet me. So I actually don't care what they think. And my friends already know what I think. So I don't care. You know, that's fine too. But the ones that make me nervous, I live in a really small town. And so when the people at the post office or at the grocery store, if they say, hey, what are you working on? I'm always like, oh, I'm scared to, you know, to say I'm this radical guy that now they're going to hate me at the grocery store or something. Anyway, so the very conservative dentist says to me, so what books have you done lately? And I said, well, I did this book, Myth of Human Supremacy, and it's about how humans really aren't so special and that, that plants can think and that plants are very sentient and that fungus is, and bacteria is very sentient. And he said, the stories I could tell you, it was great. He said, the stories I could tell you. He said, for example, there's that stuff. It's really, really smart. I've been reading studies about this. It's really smart. And he couldn't remember the name. I said, are you talking about slime mold? He said, yeah, slime mold is so smart. I was like, I couldn't believe this from my fairly conservative dentist, but it was great. Anyway, so the point is that we in this culture generally believe that humans are superior to everybody else and anybody else can only be intelligent insofar as their intelligence mimics ours. And the point is that, that everybody else is intelligent. The world consists of all these other sentient beings, not just animals, but plants, trees here with lives as valuable to them as mine is to me and yours is to you. And here's my real point back to the PTSD, which is our culture's notion that everything is hierarchical is so deeply embedded in our perspective that we can't for the most part conceptualize that entering a world where we do have fully mutual relationships and have equal relationships with non-human others. And some people might be able to extend that to their cats or their dogs, but the entire world is this giant symphony. So the PTSD affects us in so many ways, which we can talk about if you want. But one more way I want to mention right now is that we end up perceiving the world as basically consisting of a giant game of Risk or Monopoly, where the point is to run the board and to somebody else as much as you can. And I'll say one thing about this in a second. As opposed to the world being a giant symphony where the point is to figure out what role to play and then to play your role at the proper time. I mean, it's like in a symphony, the oboe players aren't going around killing all the violin players and taking their seats. Instead, you play your part at the right moment. Well, go ahead, please. Yeah. And I want to say one more thing about this, which is Richard Dawkins has this great line about science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump troops on command and to predict what will happen and when. And he's a very famous scientific philosopher. And so this great line, science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump troops on command to predict what will happen and when. Great line. And it's also very sneaky. And it's true in that if I flip on a switch, then the light turns on. I know that's how we know that science is true. That's how it bases its claims to truth, on the fact that when I flip a switch, it comes on. But here's the problem. It's presuming, okay, epistemology is the study of how we know. And so how we know something is true, he is basing our very epistemology on the ability to control, to make matter energy jump troops on command, and to predict what will happen and when. But think about this. If you and I are in the same room, and let's say I've got a gun and I've got a hoop, and I put the hoop up and I put the gun on you and I say, look, you're going to jump through the hoops on, when I count to three. If you don't, I'm going to shoot you. Chances are really good that on the count of three, you're going to jump through the hoop. And what do you know? I'm a genius because I just made matter and energy jump troops on command, and I predicted what would happen and when. The problem is that if I point a gun at you and do this, don't you think that will destroy any possibility of us ever being friends? So it is all true for a certain sort of relationship based on hierarchy and control. And so the effects of complex PTSD, how we get that is through an entire culture that's based on this control, as well as, you know, individuals having been abused. But we have the entire culture bases its epistemology, bases its political system, bases everything about it on this desire to control its relationship with the natural world, certainly. So that's one of the central things in my work, is that I believe that we have an entire culture suffering from what Judith Herman would call complex PTSD.
That's a good point. Okay, my next question is something I think you've answered a lot before. And so I'm 24, Derek, and I only say that because I just became alert to how bad the climate, the environmental state is of our Earth. And I basically think that there's three groups. There's the deniers. There's the second group, which is the capitalist environmentalists, the people that think we can solve this with a carbon tax, which a group I was in for a few months until I found out about you guys, about you, and realized. And that's my question, is can you explain why, like, bikes and solar panels and Teslas are not sustainable?
Sure, and I'm doing that for 600 pages in a book I'll have coming out in a year and a half. I'm just about almost done with the book. And so I hope that you perceive this in the way it's offered, that how about if I read you some stuff that I wrote just today? So what I'm doing in the chapter, in this particular chapter, which is about four-fifths through the book, is I say, instead of going through and debunking every plan put forward by, you know, like the solar panels, the Teslas, et cetera, I want to have a set of guiding questions or principles by which we should evaluate any technology. And so I'm going to read like a page or two. And then after, if you have questions about this, you can ask them and then I can make it more clear. You ready? Okay, first there's the technological thing itself, whether it's a photovoltaic cell, a windmill, a battery. What is it? What is it made of? Where do these materials come from and how are they extracted from the earth? What harms do these extractions cause? Who suffers these harms? What infrastructures are required to support these extractions? What harms are caused by these infrastructures? Who suffers these harms? And someone simply saying that the materials were recycled does not insulate the technology from being subject to these questions, any more than if someone said the materials were derived from pixie dust and unicorn droppings. That's because metals recycling is incredibly toxic. Anyway, by which I said earlier in the book, by what processes and what costs were the metals removed from the electronics, the impurities removed from the metals? Even ignoring the rest of the planet, who lives in the places from which you want to extract the materials? Who calls those places home? What will happen to those places? Next, how are the materials transported and converted into their final products? How is iron ore transported, smelted? How is steel fabricated? How is steel transported, melted, turned into pieces to be used in your bright and shiny green windmill? How is windmill itself manufactured and transported? What are the on-site effects of this bright green technology? How many birds will be killed by the solar power generation facility? How many tortoises? How many bats? For what will this bright green technology be used? If it's used to generate electricity, to what purpose? Does this use of the bright green technology help the real world, the physical world, the planet that's the source of all life? Or does it help industry? Those are not the same. And when the piece of technology wears out, what happens to the materials? How toxic are they? What happens to the site? Will it be habitat for sage grouse or hoary bats or whomever used to live there? Is the point of the technology to help the earth, or is it to maintain this way of living at the expense of the earth? All of which brings us to Aldo Leopold's wonderful statement. A thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise. This is the measure by which we should judge bright green and other technologies. It's the measure by which we should judge all of our actions. So I just wrote that actually an hour ago. And the point is that, the first point is that solar photovoltaics require, for example, lots of what are called rare earths. And the mining of those is incredibly toxic. So they require extraction. And we can name any technology like this, batteries, you know, where do all the materials come from? Just follow back the chain of supply and you will see destruction all over. And and what's the purpose? You know, and so many of the bright greens say that what they're trying to do is to make civilization last a little bit longer. And that's fine, I guess, but that has nothing to do with saving the planet. I mean, if coho salmon took on human manifestation, what would they say about these? And so we could go through every tech, which is what I do in the book. We could go through every one of these technologies and talk about how destructive it is. And I want to tell one more story about that, which is that, this is just for intra-human problems too, that I was getting interviewed a couple years ago by a guy from Nature Online magazine. And he said he was a dedicated Marxist who believes that it's possible to have an industrial economy with purely voluntary exchanges. No human gets exploited. And I said, okay, great. And you live in cities? He said, yes. I said, okay, so how do you get around your city? He said, buses. I said, great. What are the buses made of? He said, well, metal and rubber and stuff. And I said, okay, so where do you get your metal? He said, mines. I said, okay, so who works in the mines? He said, well, people work in the mines. And I said, well, how do you get them to go down the mines? Because mines are one of the first forms of slavery because it is so miserable to work in mines. So you pay them an awful lot. I said, well, I don't really agree, but I'll give you that. You just pay them $1 million a year, whatever, you know, they work in mines. Great. But we do recognize that mines inevitably harm groundwater, right? And he said, yes. I said, okay, so, and they harm rivers. He said, yes. I said, so what about the people who live by the river? What are you going to do about them? He said, well, you just pay them. You pay them a lot. And he said, what if they don't want your money? He said, well, you pay them to move. And I said, what if they have been living there for 5,000 years and their ancestors are buried there and they will not leave their ancestors behind? What are you going to do then? He said, well, how many of them are there? I said, what difference does that make? Let's say there's 400. He said, well, the million people in the city vote. And they all agree that the 450 people who live by the river need to move. So you go in, you move them out. And I said, oh, I see. So you've moved from purely voluntary exchanges, all within a minute, you've moved from purely voluntary exchanges to democratic empire, land theft from indigenous people, and genocide, all so you can have a mine, all so you can have a bus. And that, for me, the reason I like telling that story is because it condenses all these problems down to less than a minute. That if you're going to have, I mean, really, all my work is based on the understanding or on the notion that if you have a thing, you can't take it out of the context of how it was made. And again, I like Beethoven's Ninth fine, and I can listen to a CD. I guess that shows how old I am, that, I mean, I'm back from the LP days even. But anyway, I can listen to a CD, but I know where the CD, I know how, what was required to fabricate that CD. And I know, even if I'm listening to it on a download, I know that electricity goes into it. How is the electricity generated? And I know that it requires this entire infrastructure. You can't just take one technology all by itself and pretend that there are not consequences from the creation and disposal of that piece of technology. So really, all I'm talking about is look at context. That's it. I mean, if you want to have the electricity from a dam, what is the dam going to do? Who is harmed by the dam? Let's ask those questions.
I think that's such a good point, and you didn't bring up this point, but somebody else at that Earth at Risk conference brought up is that we are never taught to understand the negatives of technology. It's always taught as a positive. So, for instance, cars, we never think about oil and roads and how we're going to have wars if we ever run out of oil in Saudi Arabia and blah, 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 blah. And I think that's a good point, is we're always taught as technology is the solution to everything and has no it doesn't backfire at all.
Well, I was going to say, 2% of the landmass of the U.S., I believe, is devoted to roads at this point. And it's so interesting. Cities, who are cities designed for? Cities are designed for cars. They're not actually designed for human beings. I'm not the first to make that point. But it's so fascinating to me that this is a longer discussion we can have another time, but the Lewis Mumford talked about how – he talked about democratic and authoritarian techniques. And it's a longer discussion than at this moment. But one of the points that he was making is that a technology can actually start to control your society. And that sounds weird at first, but when you think about it, you know, there are people who are very, very rich and they still want to make more money. The money itself is driving the decisions, because once you have, you know, we can name an arbitrary figure, $1 million, $500,000, $10 million, doesn't matter. Name some figure. As soon as you've got that much money, you know, you can only live in one house at a time. You can't, I mean, at some point, you have more money than you will spend. You know, there's no way that a human being could spend $100 billion or something. So at that point, it's actually the acquisition of money is a self-fulfilling, a self-perpetuating machine. And this happens with so many that the cars, who's running the economy is actually, in many ways, cars are designing cities. And right now they talk about, I mean, let's leave off. I mean, I think the whole bright green thing is very, very harmful. All the solar photovoltaics is not going to help the real world. But leave that aside for a second. Just pretend that the problem really is fossil fuels. It's like, okay, they talk about fossil fuels killing the planet, but then they say, gosh, you know, fossil fuels are necessary for the economy, and they keep using them. And it's like, dudes, we're talking about the murder of the planet. That's how much these technologies are in charge. It's extraordinary to me. Anyway, so what's your question?
Money, I guess money is a technology in some way, but money or technology has usurped all thinking.
Yeah, absolutely.
You in this movie, I forgot what the movie was called, Death at the Empire, but you also bring this up in your Earth at Risk conference speech, the conundrum, I call it the conundrum of violence, where essentially if you're an indigenous species and you're one with nature, if you're protecting your land base or being sustainable, quote unquote, if another culture develops agriculture and is violent towards you, it's a huge problem, almost naturally, because you're going to have to be violent to fight them or be killed and be taken over by violence. And have you ever thought of how to fix that in a society? First of all, do you understand my question? And
oh, yes, I understand. I mean, I'm laughing because I think about this. I think it would be an exaggeration to say I think about precisely that question every day, but probably every other day. And I was just thinking about it yesterday again, and okay, there are those who think that humans are a plague species, that humans are just evil, and I don't agree with that at all. But what I do agree with is that there is the fundamental flaw, or a fundamental flaw, is that once one culture decides to be hyper-aggressive, all the other cultures have to respond to that. And as you were saying, you can have a peaceful culture in one place, and you have a nasty, and if they have peaceful neighbors, everybody can get along. It's all fine. But if one of them is really aggressive, the others have to then learn how to defend themselves from that. And that can be fine as long as it's squabbling. I think humans, like many creatures, like probably all social creatures, are fundamentally contentious. You know, it's like an indigenous friend of mine said to me, Janet Armstrong. She said, we Indians squabble just as much as white people do. The big difference is we recognize that we're going to have to live together for the next 500 years, and my great-grandchildren might marry your great-grandchildren, so we have to figure out ways to get along. And so I'm not talking about, you know, if you have people living here and people living over there, and then even sometimes getting so mad that somebody kills somebody else. I'm not saying that people walk around, you know, in pureness and light and their farts smell like gardenias. You know, I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying as long as you can have these conflicts remain fairly calm and fairly localized, it can be okay. But if you have someone who wants to take what you've got, and someone whose way of life is based on conquest, everybody else has to figure out what to do about that. But the problem is, if their way of life is based on conquest, they have probably built up an army. They have destroyed their own land base. I mean, what you were saying about agriculture, for the listeners, I'll back this up a little bit. The one of the things agriculture does is it converts the entire land base to human use. And that, so yes, one of the things that happens is you destroy the land base, you have to find another one. The other thing it does is it temporarily gives you a surplus because you've converted everything to human use, which means you can have more humans, and you can also then have an army, and you can take over your neighbors who are not using it, which gives you a short-term competitive advantage, which you can exploit. And so how does somebody fight that? And this is a problem that I don't think has been successfully resolved in the last several thousand years. Otherwise we wouldn't be in the fix we're in. But yes, it's a huge, huge problem to which I don't know the answer. The only answer I can come up with is, and this is one reason I talk about destroying civilization, is that the only answer I can come up with is to attempt to destroy the capacity, to derail the reach of those who are destroying everything on the world. If you were able to destroy the oil economy, they could no longer destroy the middle of the oceans. They could still be jerks in their particular little point in their particular part of the world, and they could still run a really nasty scheme. But when they were running this nasty scheme, like Gilgamesh did, they couldn't actually destroy the whole planet, which is what's happening right now. So yes, it's a huge problem. And here's another part of this, is that what I know is that if we don't talk about it, we won't be able to solve it. So that's one reason I do the work I do, is because I'm a big believer in what a doctor friend of mine says, that the first step toward diagnosis is the first step toward proper treatment. And I completely agree with that, and I think that this is why I do my work, is to attempt to articulate some of these things in the hope not that it will stop it by itself, but the articulations will help inform other people's analyses and to build a movement that can do whatever is required to stop this culture from killing the planet.
Okay. So my next question is another great quote you have. You said that indigenous people tell you the first thing they need to do is decolonize their hearts and minds. How would you suggest an average suburban, fat, McDonald's-eating American do that? Or how would you suggest any listener, how would they go about decolonizing their hearts and minds?
I've been asked so many times, what does it mean to decolonize? But I don't know if anybody ever asked me, how do you start? And I guess that brings us back to the beginning of the interview. I think you start by just asking some basic questions. And it doesn't matter what your particular issue is. You can say, why is it that, I mean, I know so many women who have gotten to the core of patriarchy by starting with, why did this man sexually assault me? And then they can, asking why did this man sexually assault me, they can say, so why do men in this culture sexually assault women? Do men in every culture sexually assault women? And they can start asking those questions. So here's another way to think about this, is that I was talking to a guy who owns a computer store. This is years ago. His computer store has been driven out of business by Walmart. And when I would talk to him, I wouldn't talk about salmon because I know he doesn't care about salmon. What I would talk to him about is the fact that he's a small business owner who's being driven out by a big box store. I want to tell you two stories, okay? One of them is that I was doing a talk somewhere in the Midwest. I don't remember where. Illinois, I think. And when I do a talk, one of the things I don't really like is when teachers require students to attend, because if they're required to attend, they usually don't want to be there. And so they aren't a very good audience then. Anyway, so I was doing this talk with most of the people in the audience were required, didn't want to be there, were sitting there on their cell phones. And I'm talking about the murder planet. They don't care. I switch to try to make something interesting. I tell some stories about other stuff. They don't care. So then what happens is I start talking about the stuff about the fact that when I was in college, I asked people if they liked their jobs, and about 90% would say no. And so what does it mean? And man, their ears started perking up. They started actually putting the cell phones down for a while, some of them did, and started listening to what I was saying, because they themselves were in college aiming toward a life of painful employment that they didn't want to follow. So my point is to find those wedges, find those places where there is a problem with the system, and to start then asking questions about those problems. Why is it that we are in a system where you actually have to pay someone in order to exist on the planet? That's pretty crazy. And it's really important not to just stop with, wow, I am oppressed because I have to pay rent, because that's not the point at all. A lot of people get stuck there. The real point is to ask about this on the larger social level, and to ask what it means socially. The point is not to present yourself as a victim of the system, especially when, given the fact that most of your listeners and most of my readers are in the United States, which makes it really hard on a global scale for us to really call ourselves victims. You know, we're still pretty high on the ladder compared to, you know, I mean, whenever I start to feel self-pity about anything, I always say, God, you know, I could be a stevedore in Mumbai. I could be working in a coal mine in China. You know, there are people out much worse than we do, even though we got to pay rent. But the point is asking those questions, starting to figure out those wedges, or asking people. You know, the other story I wanted to tell was about this time I was in, when I lived in Eastern Washington, I was up getting firewood out of the National Forest one day. That's from slash piles, and my pickup got a flat tire. I'm way back there, so I'm not going to walk out. I'm thumping. Oh yeah, I checked the spare. My spare, of course, I hadn't checked the spare in years. The spare was flat too. So I'm not going to walk, and I'm thumping out at a mile an hour. I get this guy's house, and I stop and I ask him if he has a pump. And he says, no, I don't, but I got a spare you can use. That was really nice of him. So he gave me the spare. I drive home. The next day I get the spare fixed, and then I drive back up and I take him a cake to thank him. I give him his spare back. I give him the cake. He says, hey, you want a piece? I go in this house. It's clear he's a logger. This guy, he literally has chainsaws on his wall like most people have paintings. And so we're just chatting a little bit. He says, hey, you know, I got a bunch of wood out back. Do you want some more firewood? I'll just cut you some lengths. I said, that'd be great. So we walk out back. He's holding a chainsaw. And he says, by the way, what do you do? I'm thinking, oh, man, here we go. I said, I'm a writer. He said, what do you write? I said, I'm thinking science fiction, fantasy. But I'm a really bad liar. And so I say to him, well, I'm writing a book right now about how the big four timber companies got their land illegally from the public domain. He starts swearing and turns red in the face. I'm looking for a break in the fence. And all of a sudden, after about 30 seconds, I realize that he's an independent logger who's been put out of business by Plum Creek Timber Company. He hates Plum Creek even worse than I do, which I didn't think was possible. Give us another 30 seconds. We got our arms around each other's shoulders just swapping atrocity stories about how much we hate Plum Creek. He hates them for what they've done to him. I hate them because of what they're doing to land. And so we then make a pact. We say, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to work together to bring down Plum Creek. And then I look at him. I say, you know, I'm against all industrial logging, so after we take out Plum Creek, I'm coming after you. And then we both just start laughing because we realize that taking out Plum Creek would be the work of a lifetime. And here's my point, is that so far as decolonizing, I think the first step, where we want to get to with decolonizing, is to make your loyalty to the land and to your local community, but especially to the land and to its non-human members, and away from the system, and to recognize that the system is not serving you or the planet in many ways. And so that's where you want to get to. And I think, how do you get there? The first step is by recognizing, it's like the Alcoholics Anonymous thing. Isn't the first step of that? I don't really know. But isn't the first step of the 12 steps recognizing there's a problem? And so I think the first step is to recognize there's a problem. And then to just, once those questions start, don't ever let them stop and just keep asking the questions and letting them spiderweb their way out.
No, it takes time for people to figure, you know, for it to percolate in their mind, I guess, for them to.
It takes years. It takes years. And that's something also that's really problematical, because a lot of people don't have that time. Honestly, I would not have had the time. There are some writers who do it, but I would not have had the time had I had children. I've got friends who have children, and that, if you have children, I mean, your life is devoted to being a good parent. And you don't necessarily any longer have, I mean, there are so many times when I'm writing, I'll get stuck. So much of my writing time consists of what a lot of people would consider doing nothing, just like taking long walks and not, you know, a long enough walk that I can stop obsessing about this or that thing that has just made me mad and just start really, you know, working on the writing. And when I was in my 20s, that's part of the reason that I was able to, that I'm so prolific these days, is that I spent a lot of my 20s really getting grounded and getting centered. It took years of sort of vomiting up the effects of industrial schooling, vomiting up the effects of all sorts of other things. That takes great time. There's this great line by Joseph Campbell, which is basically, everybody of all times until recently has recognized that in order to have anything approaching a spiritual life required leisure. And so I am fully aware that this culture, I mean, for God's sake, late stage capitalism has made leisure even more difficult than it was 50 years ago. You know, I think it's great that women are not prohibited from certain jobs. I think that's wonderful. I'm not saying anything bad about that at all. That's an unalloyed good. But what that hides is the fact that in the 1950s, a lot of families were able to survive on one income. So capitalism has taken the fact that women are not prohibited from jobs, but frankly, a lot of families are having a hard time surviving on two incomes now. And that makes even less leisure to question the system. And if we go further back, it's pretty crazy. Back in the so-called dark ages, I've read that basically they had more leisure time than we have now. It's some people did at least. And the point is that, you know, for God's sake, this is the way that technology has really been in charge again, is that the idea was always that, you know, increasing technology would actually make people so they have to work less, but it really hadn't worked out that way, has it? Anyway, back to the original thing. The thing is, to start the questioning and then just don't stop. And yes, it takes time. It takes years, and it takes getting, you know, when I used to teach at Eastern Washington University, sometimes I would, you know, my students would be writing something and they would say, gosh, you know, I'm trying to write on this certain topic and I'm really confused. And then they would get so frustrated with me because I would say, hey, that's great. Wonderful. And it's like, why are you happy I'm confused? And I say, because confusion is actually good, because first you're sure, and then you get new information, and then you get all confused, and then you get frustrated, and then you think about it for a long time, and then you give up, and then you curse, and then about a month later, you know, you will see some answer, and or maybe not. And the point is that, yes, it takes a long, long time. And everybody has understood this through all of human prehistory and history, through all of human existence. People have understood this. And this is one of the good things about being, about, this is why you keep elders around. This is why elders have a useful function in society, is because they have, as Vine Deloria told me, that from his perspective and from what he was talking about as an indigenous perspective, that the point of old age is that when you have gotten to that stage and you're no longer capable of going out hunting or going out and doing the harder physical work or the gathering or whatever it is that you're going to do, then you have the time to sit back back, and as he said, reflect upon the patterns that you have noticed.
Yes. And we live in a great point. Sorry, one point I wanted to make is you made up a point about how leisure time and how we've lost leisure time. And in Athens, they used to pay citizens for participating in democracy. So they would encourage people to be political by paying them. I guess my one question is, just a personal thought I have, is that I've decided to become political, to become an activist, because, you know, if I don't overthrow capitalism, if we don't overthrow capitalism, Mother Nature is going to do that for us. And I guess my question is, how do you think about, I guess, being a rebel? Do you think about it that way or in a different way that, you know, if we don't fix our problems, Mother Nature is the ultimate, master and is going to clean up things anyway? Like, no matter what, capitalism is going to become overthrown or civilization is going to be overthrown, whether we do it or not. And is that what keeps you motivated or is it something else? That's what motivates me.
That's a great motivator, and that's part of what motivates me. Another part that motivates me is simply I don't want for this to be a world without frog song. And then another thing to think about is that this goes along with what you're saying. This is perhaps a different way of saying the same thing you are, that if every day longer that capitalism lasts is how much weaker the world is. And sometimes, and this really annoys me, sometimes I get accused of just hating people and, you know, basically by wanting to bring down civilization that I am wanting to kill lots of people. Well, first off, that doesn't include non-human people, you know, who are being killed right now. It also doesn't include the really poor. That if the electrical grid went down, the 40% of humans who don't have access to electricity right now are not going to be harmed at all. They'll be in better shape. Because right now, for example, in India, there are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe. So I asked both Anuradha Mittal and Vandana Shiva if India would be better off if the global economy disappeared tomorrow. And they both laughed and said, yes, of course. But anyway, leaving all that aside, there is a carrying capacity of the planet, which is carrying capacity is how many of a certain species can live in a certain place permanently without harming the land base. So you can have an island that can hold 1,000 deer, can hold them forever. And if there were 10,000 deer there, they would eat too much and poop too much and walk around too much and permanently lower the carrying capacity. Every day that passes, the carrying capacity is getting lower. So every day that passes, the world is weaker. And so the longer we put off this collapse, the worse the world is. And the worse will be things for those humans to come after. So that's one of the things that really motivates me, is that the longer we wait for this culture to collapse on its own, the worse things are going to be for those humans who come out. I mean, for God's sake, if somebody would have brought down civilization 200 years ago, people in the northeastern United States could still eat passenger pigeons. If they would have brought it down 100 years ago, people in the Northwest could still support themselves with salmon. And every day that passes, things are worse for those who come after.